So hello, everyone. Today, I'm going to talk about how can you design scalable NUMA-aware blocking synchronization primitives for large machines, like which can have more than 100 physical cores. I'm Sanidhya, and this is a joint work with my advisors, Dr. Changwoo Min and Dr. Taisoo Kim. So let's get started. We have seen that there are like lot of large machines coming out. For example, HP has already has a 16-socket machine that has like 24 cores per socket. Even Oracle has like an M7 machine that can have up to 4096 threads. Well, it is not only limited to these machines. We are also observing that there are 128 vCPU VMs that are available from Amazon, which are called X1 instances. Well, with the introduction of these machines, it's not very easy to program or like actually utilize these machines properly, because they add some sort of problem because of the non-inform access. So let me give you an example. Why the NUMA awareness is important. So suppose there are multiple threads in a two-socket machine, which I denote as NUMA node 1 and NUMA node 2, and they are trying to access a file. One of them is the lock holder, which is just trying to access, and then there is a sort of a queue. So if it's a NUMA oblivious, so what will happen is that, so in this case, whenever the lock is passed from W1 to W2 or to a different socket, there will be a large latency in the sense that it actually takes around almost 1.6 times more latency to actually access a cache line across a socket. However, if we convert this to a NUMA aware or like localize the lock, what can happen is that the W1 and W6 can access together, and then W4 and 5 can access together, like the other ones in the NUMA node 2 can access together. By doing this, we can actually mitigate the cache line bouncing. This is good in the sense that what if we have the synchronization primitives which are trying to access critical data structures, or like they are common in nature. Well, this is not a new idea, and we can see that there has been a lot of research in terms of locks, like from going back to like dating back to like 1960s. Well, till 1990s, people have tried to actually decrease the cache line contention in some form or the other. But after the introduction of these non-inform memory access machines, we see that there has been a lot of locks such as HBO, hierarchical backoff lock, hierarchical lock, HCLH, cohort lock, remote core locking approaches, or even like Malthusian lock. But what can we observe from this if we look from the OS perspective is such as Linux. What we observe here is that still now, when the Linux was actually implemented, it was still using like TTAS-based lock. And TTAS is still being used by blocking synchronization primitives such as mutex and read-write semaphore. There is like, we can see that the spin lock is now using a queue-based spin lock approach, but it took like almost 15 years to actually get into the mainline. The reason for this is that because it's not very easy to take any lock and use it. And there are also like other constraints like programming argument, as well as the memory size. Thus, what we can say is that if we want to adopt a NUMA-aware lock, it's not going to be easy. So let me give you what are the challenges if we look from the NUMA-aware primitives. The first one is the memory footprint overhead. What I mean by memory footprint overhead is like, let's take an example of a cohort lock, which is a sort of a state-of-the-art lock, and it is a hierarchical lock in nature. Its size is around 1600 bytes, but if we compare it against a Linux kernel mutex implementation or a read-write semaphore implementation, it's 40 bytes. And if we try to replace this lock in an inode, we may be wasting around 1 to 4 gigabytes of memory just for 10 million of inodes, whereas it will be only 38 megabytes of memory for the Linux mutex. This is one of the concerns. The another problem that comes is that the prior works have not focused solely on the blocking or parking behavior. So here I'll be interchangeably using the parking and blocking, but both of them mean like I'm talking about like they can be scheduled out. Since I say parking or blocking, let me give you a small primer on this. So here we have a figure which shows the lock throughput and the number of thread count. So the green side represents the undersubscription. What I mean by undersubscription is that the number of threads are less than the number of cores that are trying to acquire the lock, or the oversubscription, in which what it means is like the number of threads are actually greater than the number of cores. So the basic approach which we use when we talk about spin lock is it is actually spinning. So when it is actually spinning, it performs the best as long as we are undersubscribed, but it starts to suffer from cache line and lock holder preemption problem as soon as we cross the core boundary, number of cores. Whereas if you see the yellow line, which represents parking, what I mean by parking here is that the threads can be scheduled out. They can either yield or like block. This is what parking means. It actually performs better in the case of an oversubscribed scenario, but not in the case of undersubscribed scenario, because it's like you keep on yielding because of no apparent reason. That's another way of putting it. So the ideal way can be like, what if we do a sort of a spin then park-based approach? Well, this is what is called a spin then park strategy, which is being used by the existing synchronization primitives, blocking synchronization primitives. So there what they do is like they spin for a certain duration, and after spinning, they add, if they cannot acquire the lock, they park themselves to a parking list, which is a global parking list, and then schedule themselves out. The problem with this approach is that it is inefficient in nature, which I will show you later why, which I'll talk about why it is happening. But if we look at all these previous slides which I have mentioned, the major problem with the synchronization primitives, the blocking synchronization primitives, is that if we want to take newer aware locks, they have a very high memory footprint. Whereas if we want to make them blocking in nature, the existing approach already suffers from scheduling overhead because it is being involved in the critical path, as well as we are suffering from the cache line contention while doing the parking part. Thus, we propose CST lock, which is a newer aware lock, and tries to address both of these problems in the sense that it has a low memory footprint by using a very simple idea of like allocating the socket structures on the fly when required. By doing this, we actually save around 1.5 to 10x memory when going across a socket when compared with a cohort lock. And it has an efficient parking and wake-up strategy, which improves the scalability of the lock of the applications by 1.2 to 4.7x, depending on the kind of application we are using. Now I'll go into a bit more detail what does NUMA aware and like what are the things that mean. So first thing is the NUMA aware lock. When I say NUMA aware lock, it actually follows the principle of a cohort lock principle in the sense that it is a hierarchical lock and has two locks. But one is the global lock and the other one is the local lock. You first acquire the local lock and then the global lock, and then you release the global lock and the local lock. By using the cohort lock principle, we actually remove the cache line contention and bouncing problem in the case of undersubscribed scenario. The other problem that we try to address is the memory efficiency or the memory consumption footprint that is happening because of the NUMA aware locks by allocating the socket structures when required. And these socket structures are always there until the life cycle of the lock. By doing this, we actually do not stress the memory allocator, which happens in various cases, which we'll show later in the evaluation as well. Now there are two parts which I'll discuss from the blocking perspective. The first one is the parking part. So since even in the case of oversubscribed scenario, there is a possibility that we might be adding ourselves to the parking list. So in order to mitigate that contention problem, what we do is like we maintain a separate per socket parking list for both readers and writers separately. By doing this, we actually mitigate the cache line contention in an oversubscribed scenario. And it has one more advantage in the sense that if you are implementing a read-write lock based approach, read-write locks, it allows distributed wake up of the readers in the sense that you can wake up a reader on each socket and they can actually further wake up other readers. The other point is how to remove the scheduler intervention. So since it's a queue-based lock which we are using, so we break the invariant, we actually relax the invariant in the sense that instead of passing the lock to the very next lock waiter, we actually pass the lock to the very next spinning waiter. Furthermore, we also allow the waiters to park themselves out regarding whatever the lock holder is doing. And it depends on the system load. By doing these two points, these two approaches, we actually remove the scheduler from the critical path and try to guarantee some sort of forward progress in the system. Now I'll give a very brief idea of how the lock looks like from the mutex perspective. So initially it has whenever the lock is instantiated, we have a socket list and which doesn't contain anything, and the global tail denotes the global queue, the global lock part. And suppose we have like four threads coming up, so threads T1 to T4, T1 to T3 belonging to socket 1, and then T4 belongs to socket 2. Since T1 came and since there was no allocation, it allocates the lock and allocates the socket-specific structure, which is the S-node 1 on socket 1. And then T2 and T3 comes and they don't allocate anything here. Later, T4 comes because it's on socket 2. It allocates the S-node structure and updates the socket list, which is the bit vector, which we maintain for across the whole life cycle. Now let's take a very simple example of how we acquire a lock or a wait or a thread acquires a lock. We have the same example here, like thread T1 to T4 are coming. T1 comes and sees there's no one. It will actually allocate the socket structure. The socket structure has four points, like four elements. The first is the state. The next two are the parking and the waiting queue. And the last one is for the maintaining the global queue for the lock. So if you remember the MCS or the queue-based lock, so they have a state, and the state comprises of two elements. The first is the logged, which denotes L, and the other one is waiter. So we actually extend the waiting state to have unparked waiter and a parked waiter, so which can be changed by the waiter itself. Initially, all of them actually starts from the unparked waiter state, and the S node is still unlocked. Now T1 will actually allocate a structure on the stack, and since it's the first one in the queue, it will allocate it will become a lock holder. And then it will ask to acquire the lock because since it's a lock holder, so it wants to acquire the global lock as well in order to enter the critical section. Since there is no one in the socket, like besides socket one, there is no one in the queue, the global queue, it acquires the lock and enters the critical section. Similarly, T2 comes, and since it's in the socket one and lock T1 already holds the lock, T2 becomes the next waiter. Same thing happens with the T3. And when T4 comes to socket 2, it actually allocates the lock and becomes a lock holder in the socket 2. Let's take an example of a parking phase. What happens, how the blocking is working at a very high level. So here we again have the same states. Now what happens is, like, suppose T2, there are more tasks running on the CPU on which T2 is actually running. What happens in this case is, like, the T2 will atomically change its status from UW to PW, which is the parking status, and then update the parking tail to point to itself. So just to denote that, okay, this is one of the waiters that is sleeping. So this whole, both of these operations happen atomically, which we have to ensure because we want the lock holder to know later what is happening. This is how, at a very high level, the parking is working. Now, I'll cover a case of an unlock phase, which is like, how do we actually pass a lock to a spinning waiter? Suppose we have the same scenario, but I have removed the socket 2 structure from this, and I'm just talking about the first three threads, which are T1, T2, and T3, and they are all spinning on the socket 1. As mentioned earlier, we have the same state as, like, the T1 is still in the critical section, and T2 has parked itself out, and then T1 is about to release the lock. Now it has to pass on the lock. So in the conventional way, it would have to wake up the T2 and pass on the lock to that T2. But in our scenario, what happens is, like, we actually pass on the lock to T3, which becomes a lock holder and goes on to and enters the critical section. There are two more states in the unlock phase, and which it's better if you guys can have a look at our paper to understand it properly. In terms of implementation, we have implemented our, we implemented both read-write locks and the mutex in the Linux kernel, and we have modified the inode structure of the file system as well as the mmapsem, which is a memory management part of the Linux kernel. Please refer our paper for the read-write lock implementation as well as the corresponding pseudocode. We have also open-sourced our part of our code online. In order to evaluate our locks, like, we want to answer two important questions. Like, what is the memory footprint as well as the scalability of applications from the lock perspective? And how effective is our blocking or parking strategy? So we use an 8-socket 120-core NUMA machine for our evaluation. And we don't run anything on the hyperthreads. I'll cover a case study of an application called PSearchy, which is a parallel search and indexer. So what it does is, like, it allocates threads, the threads runs on a particular CPU, and they allocate, And the way they work is that they read a set of files, which we provide, and then they actually cache them in the memory, and then they perform the operation. which is a memory read, so which is a memory write intensive as well as file system read intensive operation. Here the throughput represents the number of jobs done in an hour by the PSearchy application, and the memory utilization is the total number of the log size used, the size of the logs being used, which is in megabytes. So what happens is that furthermore, the vanilla means the Linux native implementation. The cohort log is, we have actually ported a cohort log to the kernel, and the CST is our own implementation, which here we are talking about the read-write logs. So if we observe that in case of CST, what it actually outperforms both Linux mutex version as well as the cohort log, because the Linux mutex is actually following a blocking behavior and starts to suffer from the scheduling overhead most of the time. Whereas the cohort log has a problem with, because there are so many logs are instantiated, it cannot come up with the, it keeps on rescheduling at that time. Whereas in the case of memory utilization, what we observe is that since we actually use around 100,000 files, because of the 100,000 files, it has to allocate so many logs even though the thread is using a particular socket, but for the cohort log, it has to allocate all the, for each socket. Because of this, it ends up using around 9.1x more memory than the CST log. In summary, our approach overcomes the memory footprint as well as the scheduling overhead for both of these logs, and uses less than, for most of the application, it uses 1.5 to 9.1x less memory compared with the cohort log. And it further improves the throughput of other applications, including PSearchy, by 1.4 to 1.6x. Now I'll talk a bit about the parking strategy, how effective is it. So here we take two micro benchmarks from our previous paper, which was FXMark, which was published last year in ADC, which here we talk about, the first benchmark is the file creation micro benchmark. So what happens is each thread creates a file, a 4 kilobyte file, and that's all they are doing for a certain duration, till they fill the 32 gigabytes of memory. Here the x-axis represents the number of threads and y-axis is the median number of operations per second. What we observe here is that we actually oversubscribed till 240 threads. What we can observe here is that if we take the case of mutex, which is the vanilla version, it performs better till the socket boundary, and after that it starts to suffer from the cache line contention as well as the scheduling overhead. Whereas the CST log maintains the performance till 120 threads. On the other hand, if you look at the cohort log, what is happening with that is that since a single file is being created, it has to allocate an inode which is already bloated by 3.8 times. So therefore, it is actually suffering from the memory bloat issue here, and is stressing the memory the memory allocator. As soon as we go beyond the 120 threads, what we observe is that the performance falls even in case of CST as well as in case of mutex. The reason is that we have we are now stressing the memory allocator, because all the threads wants to allocate a 4 kilobyte chunk as well as the inode structure. So therefore, for both of them, we see almost similar kind of degradation for a mutex, Linux kernel mutex, and a CST. Now I'll talk about the other benchmark, which is the directory read benchmark or directory enumeration benchmark. It actually stresses the read-write semaphore, or the reader side of the read-write semaphore. What is happening in this case is that CST is able to maintain the performance, while the cohort log and both, the cohort log starts to suffer from the rescheduling problem, but the mutex, even though it doesn't suffer from the rescheduling problem, it suffers from the cache line contention. The reason is that it has to atomically update the read count globally, which is not true with the CST log, because it maintains the read counter on a per socket basis. And if we see beyond 120 threads, it's still performing almost better, because it keeps on incrementing the read counter inside the socket. In summary, if we look at the performance of both of these benchmarks, so our parking strategy is performing optimal in both under and oversubscribed scenario, and further improve the scalability of these operations, file system operations, by 1.3 to 3.7x. In summary, we implemented two blocking synchronization primitives called mutex and the read-write semaphore. We tried to address two problems from these synchronization primitives. The first one is the NUMA-aware, the allocation of the NUMA-aware locks, where we dynamically allocate the locks. dynamically allocate the socket specific structure, and then we try to come up with an efficient spin and spark strategy, which is scheduling aware and tries to remove the caching contention from the parking list. Thank you for listening to me, and with that, I'll be happy to take questions.
Question.
Hi, this is Jaro from UT Arlington. This is a very good work. But is it possible to cause starvations to some of the waiters? For example, if you always pass the lock to a spinning waiter, what if the waiter gets locked and quickly exits the critical section and then requests the lock again? Then are you going to give this lock again and again to the same waiter?
So you're saying like we just have one lock. So, but are you talking about do we have multiple threads or not?
So especially in a undersubscribed scenario,
yeah,
you have more cores than more.
So in the case of undersubscribed scenario, it usually does not sleep. It behaves as a non-blocking lock.
But
because we actually check the system load. So the way we check the system load, like I have not talked about the system load part, it's like we check the number of tasks that are in the run queue. Mm-hmm. And from that is our metric to figure out how many tasks are running. So if the task is only one, it means that this is the only guy. And we just keep on spinning, even though we know that, okay, we should preempt out and allow the others to go.
Yes, but what if a lock holder releases the lock and quickly requests lock again,
yes,
becomes another spinning waiter? So is it possible that this waiter will get prioritized to get the lock again?
So are there any other waiters in that lock, in that socket?
There are other waiters, but they're all parked.
So the thing is, even if it comes, it has to wake up some, so the lock holder has to release the lock. And at the time of releasing the lock, it has to wake that guy up, one of the parked waiter, because it first releases the global lock, passes to someone, releases the global lock, and then it wakes up the guy who is sleeping, the last guy, and then passes the then wakes up the and then goes out actually.
Yeah, but what if there are two spinning waiters? They are just exchanging the locks again and again. Then all the other parking lockers will not get chance to get the lock.
I didn't listen properly, sorry.
So there are two spinning waiters.
Yes, so in the same socket or in the separate socket?
Whatever, in the same socket.
Okay.
And then they are passing, exchanging the lock between each other.
Yes.
Blocking all the parking waiters.
So, okay, so the thing is like we keep a batch count. So if you look at the cohort lock, so the cohort lock has a principle like in the sense that we ensure we have short-term unfairness. So we will only allow for a certain duration, like number of counts, and then pass on the log back. Like
okay,
it will pass to the second socket.
Yeah, this will solve the problem. Okay, thank you.
Okay. I was wondering how you pick the sort of length of spinning, because in my experience, that's very sort of dependent on a whole variety of factors, including the application and the system load and number of cores and the bus speed, things like that. How do you pick that, and how do you know that it's that you've picked the right value when, in my experience, it's very application dependent, and also you just have one application, I think, in your evaluation.
So are you talking about the value? Which value are you talking about? Can I know that?
For spin and park, like how long?
Okay,
how do you know how long to spin?
Okay.
Right? Because my experience that it can change depending on your application.
So there we don't pick any value. It's the scheduler that tells us whether you should park yourself out or not. So if there is an API in the Linux kernel, if you look from that perspective, so we can know when it should be preempted or not preempted. So from that, there is a TIFF variable. If I go into the implementation details, I don't want to go there. So you can figure out if you're in the kernel space, the scheduler will let you know that you should go out. You should schedule yourself out.
Right, but if it's less than the whole time slice.
Less than
a? I mean, I guess. So what you're saying is that potentially you could end up spinning your whole, spinning until the next scheduling interval, even if that's not optimal. So it might be too large, or it could also possibly be too small.
I didn't listen to the last part.
Let's take it offline.